The theme for the afternoon talk is empathy and forgiveness. I assume everybody knows the meaning of both words, since they will be repeated. You have probably have been hearing about and reading quite recently, and perhaps seen on the television news, this appalling and dreadful plight of families of men, women and children who are living and have been living in the most desperate and painful of circumstances in various parts of the Middle East and Africa. And the outcome all of that is a huge amount of suffering. And when families are living in such desperate circumstances, the only way that they can see a way out of it is by flight, by escaping, by getting away from it. And of course, the internal circumstances, the conflicts and the divisions, and especially the external circumstances of the wars that we have been making, declaring and continuing on a range of countries here in the Middle East and right through, of course, to Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and so forth, and also in Africa. It means that people need to find a place of refuge somewhere where those families and those individuals can come to and have some degree of safety. And so we read about in the newspapers of the asylum seekers, the refugees, the immigrants, the huge numbers of displaced people. But unfortunately, and very, very sadly, and it's a very severe comment on the culture and society which we live. We, that is we in Europe, we here in Israel, seem to be making it increasingly more difficult to offer any authentic or genuine kind of hospitality to people who are suffering, who've lost their homes, who've lost many of their loved ones, whose towns, villages and cities have been desecrated by our bombs, by our weaponry. And when they come to take refuge, to find a new way of life and leave all which they have loved and supported, they are finding more and more and increasingly so that in fact they're unwelcome. That everything possible is being made to make their life more and more difficult. With the variety of detention camps which are set up, endless interviews by the immigration authorities, and living in this very painful and unhappy circumstances of being in limbo. Can't go back, can't go forward, and unwelcome and unwanted where they are. And I think we as caring and kind human beings surely ought to be feeling an immense degree of concern about this suffering and this ongoing human tragedy. And the circumstances of all of this, of course, is that what is occurring is that we are buying through the media, through the newspapers, the propaganda that we can't take people. And all sorts of rationalizations are put forward about space, about numbers, about work, about economic realities, or whatever. And so in the guise of these kind of views, this blocking out, these detention camps, this sending people back to where they come from, shows a lack of kindness, a serious lack of empathy, a lack of compassion, and a cold-hearted self-centeredness. I think we as hopefully caring and thoughtful people need to be speaking up, need genuinely to find ways to express our concern. And I'm reminded of the kind of divisions that separate people from people. And sometimes the circumstances of those separations is in what we might describe as a kind of cultural relativity. And this cultural relativity that we sometimes believe in and sometimes we identify, we have this arrogance of ourself, of our ego, which fuels or takes the view somehow we, whoever the we is more important. We because we were here first. We because we have our religion. We because we have our cultural tradition. We because of our gender. We because of our years of promotion of the self, of the collective self. We, our nation state, with our particular colour and our particular background. And all of this dreadful language, this cultural, religious, social, political language, is used as a weapon to exclude people. As I say, it doesn't show kindness, it doesn't show hospitality. And so right now as we speak, both here in Israel and certainly in Europe, we see literally and figuratively huge walls which are going up. And those walls, in various ways, are to exclude and to deny people a basic human freedom, and that is the freedom of movement. The freedom to feel loved, the freedom to feel supported. And there are people in this room and elsewhere who are deeply familiar with circumstances, personally and through work, with the plight of immigrants and asylum seekers and refugees. And I just want to put out a strong support for them. If we take Europe at the moment, where of course thousands are crossing the Mediterranean, are crossing the seas and making overland journeys, thousands die en route. It's no easy journey. They have only the clothes that they are wearing, these families. And then they find there's the tear gas. There is the barbed wire, as the British have put up at the port of Calais, with thousands trying to cross to come into Britain. There's the army and the soldiers there at the stations, railway stations, stopping people from boarding the trains. I mean, this is monstrous behaviour. And how in the passage of time, I've been reading in the newspapers, how things have changed. In Germany, which I go to regularly, with all of its appalling history from the last century, and how things have changed there. The German government has agreed in the next year to allow 800,000 immigrants and refugees, asylum seekers, to live in Germany. The number which was allowed into Britain last summer from Syria was 172. It's this kind of separate and division with the walls which are being built. And just as it was horrendous, the Berlin Wall and the splitting of a country, just as horrendous is the wall of separation, which is a tragedy between the country of Israel and the country of Palestine. With the walls which are being built and the high fences to block people, to stop people, we need our voice. We need to be asking ourselves in all of this, is my silence contributing to this? Is my silence enabling this to go on? Have I accommodated it to such a degree that no longer do I speak it? No longer do I wish to bring up any painful issues. No longer do I wish to actually go deep in myself and feel empathy for those who are far, far worse off. And for that, we will need to, as a matter of important urgency, to go much deeper than this cultural relativism, this religious social relativism, which is such an appalling block to actually touching our humanity. There are far more important things than social, political, religious beliefs. There's our humanity. it runs much deeper, because there are no barriers and no divisions and no lines in one's humanity. It has an infinite potential. And on a rather softer note, I could go on and on, but on a rather softer and amusing, mildly amusing note, in some ways, when I was here last year, instead of flying back from Tel Aviv back to the rain on that little wet island off the west coast of Europe, and then I went from Tel Aviv to Berlin, and to my not surprise, because I knew already, but on board the flight, the plane, pretty well from my small observation, was full of young Israelis. I mean, full. And so as I sat there on this cheap airline, having some cheap orange juice, it wasn't cheap actually, and I was thinking how it can be that in the space of two or three generations, your own parents, for some of you, your own grandparents, couldn't get away from Germany quick enough, and understandably with the horrendous circumstances of needing to take flight from the most horrific situations there. And two or three generations now, there are lots of Israelis, young Israelis, who can't get back to Berlin quick enough. And I've been hearing that when some of your parents and grandparents first came here, they threw their German passports overboard into the River Med. Now I'm hearing there are young Israelis swimming around in the Med looking for these grandparents' passports so they can get back. And I think if things can change to that degree in the space of, 60 or 70 years, this wall can come down of separation. People can flow and meet and connect with each other, can move freely there, and this wall also can come down, and the sooner the better. In looking into the outer world of the world of empathy, we tend to have this institutionalized way of looking and way of thinking. And what I mean by that, we are so used to putting everything into the compartments, like I did a few moments ago, cultural relativity, religious relativity, science, and sociology, and psychology, and spirituality, and secularism, much else. And we forget that the helpfulness and the limits of these constructs is something which human beings have put together. And there is some kind of intentionality to put groups of people into compartments. And once people are in the compartments, there is, of course, the gap. And with the gap, there is the separation there. And it easily leads to being for or against. I'm with you because you're with us, I'm against you because you're against us. And this compartmentalizing, this dualism, to use Indian language here, the dualism of that inhibits the opportunity to go deep. And to go deep is to explore and to put aside all the ideologies, the nation state being one of them, to look deeper and to see if I can find in my being an empathy which is more important than the compartments. I mean, in a very simple way, no country is written on the earth. There is nothing on the land. And in this country, it's even more problematic because one doesn't know where Israel finishes and Palestine starts, so it's a real mess here. So there's this world in which we've imposed through thought and through lines on paper this and that. Much of this Middle East was devised by some guy in Paris in the years of occupation, and some guy in London, working together in 1916, and they just divided up sections of the Middle East. They literally got a ruler out and made countries. That protest, often that goes on, is the feeling as well that the compartmentalizing, it creates the divisions, and divisions creates the wars and the civil wars. We, Dharma exploration, to go deeper, is to appreciate the human mind has made the divisions, and the human heart has the potential for the empathy. So that we hold the idea, I mean, I think it's a silly idea, I am English. What does that mean? And the even a little bit of empathy will show how much we have in common. I have not yet, and I've done a little bit of travelling on this earth, travelled round this world, and have not yet met anybody whose head is not on top of their neck and their shoulders. I've not yet met anybody in this world whose eyes are not above their nose, and everybody I have met so far, their mouth is below their nose, and the two ears are stuck on the side of the head. I've not met a single exception. If you know anybody, I mean, I know Israel's a bit eccentric, if you know anybody, just please let me know. There. And despite the fact of in common, eyes here, nose here, mouth here, ears here, head here, every hand has always had an arm it's been connected to. There's so much in common, so much is shared, why can't we see that? And even though it's so, so similar, it's not to reduce things to sameness, because if we were all the same, we wouldn't know who was who. Would we? Because we'd all look exactly the same. I know they do in the Knesset, but I'm talking elsewhere. Apologies? No apologies. So, the little differences between eyes and nose and mouth and here and here and here are very small, but it's just enough to know the differences. So it's the recognition of the differences, but the differences are based on what is in common. The differences there is based on eyes. I'm going to repeat myself. It's a mantra: eyes above the nose above the mouth, and ears stuck on the side of the head. That's in common. Every human being we know looks like this. The actuality is, can I, as a practice, with the reminder of the human face here, see what is so obviously in common at the most superficial level, the appearance of the face, and meanwhile recognizing and acknowledging the differences, but so that the differences do not overcome what is in common. If you do, it's racism. If you do, it's homophobia. If you exaggerate the difference, it's prejudice. It's projections. It's violence. It's killing. It's destruction. If you see the differences, and one little exaggeration of the differences will put the self first, the self of the people, the self of us, the self of the country, and it will put others as inferior, and when once people are inferior, they can be killed. Why? Because the common has been forgotten. The common of feelings and thoughts and experiences, this has been neglected. And our challenge to go deep, to go be deeper than identity, is to recognize, as we have a left hand and a right hand, to recognize profoundly, deeply what we have in common, and to recognize and appreciate the differences, but not to make the differences at the expense of what is in common. If they are kept close together, like the eyes and the blah, 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 onto the head, if that is kept, the differences and what is in common is kept close together, violence, war, and any verbal support for it will stop. It will stop. It's a lot of work to go deep into the being. It's a lot of work, as when the Buddha was asked, what do the wise have in common? Good question. And he gave a one-word answer. He said, the wise have in common empathy. It's what the wise share together. In the exploration of empathy, there will be this evening a loving kindness meditation, and I'd just like to speak to you about the matters of friendship and love and the heart, both as an exploration, but also as a critique, and it goes both ways. As an exploration, the access and the connection and the communication towards the heart, so it goes, shall we say, deeper than the head, as the cerebral event, which has a great place. The heart equally has a great place, and that attention and listening to the heart takes a priority, and in the taking of the priority, there is a listening which goes with it. The listening which goes with it is to recognize especially the areas of warmth and kindness. But it's more than that. So to take some examples here, which some of you have touched upon with the groups or the one-to-ones. You're engaged in the meditation, and during the flow of the meditation, you notice a person or persons in your life who begins to stand out in some way or other, and one feels and experiences inside some reactivity to this person. It was not one's intention to arrive on the retreat and spend hour after hour indulging in negativity towards some poor devil that you know. But one finds oneself immersed in the story with the agitation or the negativity, maybe about the past or in the present or whatever, and it seems to fill up the time, fill up the days with this negativity. I'll touch upon the word truth in a moment. So we could say, inwardly, as well sometimes in daily life outwardly, there is an encounter. There is an encounter, meaning there is a meeting of the self, me, I, with the other, you, him, her, or them. And in that encounter, an event happens. The event is called, it's difficult. The event is called tension, frustration, anger, hurt, jealousy, fear, disappointment, breakup, breakdown, probably a few more thousand concepts. So there is some kind of encounter, and that encounter generates an event. The event, whatever it might be, leaves a residue. It leaves an impression. saw him, saw her, and now he or she has ran off with somebody else. My kids don't speak to me. My boss hates me. And you know, all the other scenarios that go on between humans. So in the encounter, there's some anguish or pain or difficulty which takes place. That encounter there generates the event which we might talk with others, we might keep to ourselves. The key or the essential factor in this, and we've touched upon, what is it that we can bring to the encounter, it's an important thing, to see the clear truth of the situation so that the truth of the situation is looked at so clearly that it dissolves the suffering, the conflict of the encounter, of the event. And in Dharma, it's not like science. Our beloved scientists like to think they know what the truth is. But actually, it's a tremendous amount of sometimes useful knowledge. And that knowledge may change as other theories and hypotheses come in. But truth in Dharma has quite a different meaning from science. It has a different meaning from religion with its views of beliefs, including Buddhism and much else. To see the truth of a situation, to see it clearly, the confirmation of seeing the truth of the situation is that it's transformed. It is changed. One may say to oneself, well, I'm really looking at this stuff that's going on inside of me in the retreat. This happened to me some time ago. This is currently going on in my life. I really want to get it sorted out. I want to get it resolved. One has still not, in Dharma language, touched the truth of the situation. What one is maybe quite close to it, there is an authentic and genuine commitment to it, but when the truth touches the situation, the truth changes the encounter. It's looked at with fresh eyes. The issue and the conflict or the anguish goes out of it. And sometimes you and I have the privilege, and I have to say it's a great privilege, sometimes we meet women and men who have or are going through incredibly difficult situations. Sometimes it could be life-threatening. Sometimes it could be a huge loss, a separation, an unwanted, unsearched for, unasked for event that takes place. And the person has looked at it, has faced up to it, has seen the truth of it, and in the seeing of the truth of it, one is at peace with it. There's no projections into it. There's no adding to it. One has seen the truth of it, and it's the truth which gives the peace. You know the truth by the peace that it gives. You know the truth by the sense of the freedom that it gives. And quite often we, as it were, can be close to seeing the truth of things. But when we really see the truth of things, something happens. We start to act. And the action and the clarity confirms the seeing of the truth. Sometimes, both I remember here in Israel with some of the meetings that I've had in the city in Tel Aviv, and one Israeli, his daughter died some years ago, but this was at the hands of a terrorist. And of course, the anguish and the pain of that is hard for us to imagine. Those of us who are parents, if we have any wishes in life, one of them would be that we die before our children. It comes kind of, it seems to be the natural order of things. The man could, in the feeling life, could have held, as some will do, a lot of hate, the desire for revenge, and consistent blame, which would eat up any peace of mind and any happiness. But he didn't. In seeing the truth of the situation, it came to him, my goodness me, of course, there are mothers and fathers who are Palestinian who have died at the hands of the IDF. There are mother and fathers who have suffered greatly when their children have died there. And so the outcome of that empathy was to make contact. And then out of that, groups started of Israelis and Palestinians, parents of the bereaved, coming together and sharing in that empathy their experience. That's what empathy is. It's not just a feeling of concern. It's not just, oh, how it must be for others. The power, that's Buddha's word here, the power of the empathy, it leads to an action. It's the confirmation of the empathy. And it's so powerful, it transcends or goes deeper than the usual divisions. Dharma is deeply interested in this because, as the Buddha said, the wise, the noble ones, to use that kind of language that he used, the wise are the noble ones, all share this in common, a deep sense of empathy. Powerful stuff. Just in Totnes with the good lady, she sees the situation of what's going on the French border, and this cold-hearted refusal to allow these poor refugees to come into Britain there. So, in the small town of 8,000 people, in the marketplace, she's doing something. And what she's doing, she's collecting tents and food and clothing and got some trucks together and driving off to France and saying, look, our government may be cold-hearted and distant, but there are people who are not. And then out of that, people are taking things and to give support, and that helps. That's the empathy. It helps to make the connections, and in many ways, in our own homes, in our own communities, and therefore it is worthwhile in the days here. Where do I show the empathy in my daily life? What ways can I express that? What ways can I explore that? Because it's the sign of the wisdom. It's the mark of somebody who's gone deeper than our usual cultural relativism and gone much more deeply than that. One of the words in our circles that gets used quite a lot, as well as in religious circles, and it's the language of forgiveness. I don't personally use it too much. Perhaps I'm unforgiving, I'm not sure, but... So sometimes, there can be a situation, and this happens, we hear this voice regularly on the retreat, perhaps either in the past or in the present, one has done something or said something which one puts one's hand on one's heart and one really knows one really, really has hurt somebody. It may have been deliberate. it may have been accidental, but one just knows that the impact of one's voice or one's behavior or one did really, really hurt somebody. And then as we get deeper with the feelings and with the heart, it may well be that, there's a difference here, regret, awe and guilt arises. And in Dharma language, there's a big difference between the two, and it's not always so easy with the feeling life to be quite clear about what is regret and what is guilt. And so you and I have said something, or we have done something to whoever it may be, and afterwards, sometimes that day, weeks, years later, or whatever, and there is the sense of regret. The feeling of regret about what we said or what we did needs full feeling acknowledgement to really recognize this, the regret. The guilt is not helpful. The guilt is an extra layer of self in which there is a certain intensity of blaming ourselves and being really heavy and hard on ourselves. And the guilt pressure upon ourselves, it blocks the opportunity for change. It blocks the opportunity, if possible, for the fresh encounter with the other. Guilt becomes a weight, an emotional weight which one carries around, and one of the clues that one is carrying on this emotional weight, this guilt, is quite often in the sentence that people use, I should be able to forgive myself. That statement is quite often the reaction to the guilt. And because of the should, we hear these things every day in psychotherapists, every hour of the day, that the I should, the I and the should, add extra weight. It doesn't help. And one is then faced with a painful difference. I feel very guilty for what I did, or it could be, I feel very guilty for what I didn't do, and I should have done, I should have known better. I feel very guilty, and now I want to be able to forgive myself, and I can't forgive myself, I feel I should be able to forgive myself, and I am trapped in my guilt, and then in my desire for self-forgiveness. And that emotional prison we can carry around for years. Years. Because it can't be resolved through the weight of the guilt and the belief I'll be able to forgive myself. You won't. It's the mythology of the time that we live in. And then we have these, in the Buddhist world, I try to forgive them sometimes, these self-forgiveness courses. And these, another one, self-compassion courses. In Dharma, from a deeper level, it's a contradiction in terms. Yeah. And what happens is that because of something we did or we didn't do or whatever, and that reaction that comes to us, the idea that comes, the self idea comes, if I can forgive myself first, then afterwards I'll be able to make amends, I'll be able to apologize, I'll be able to show kindness to the other. The other person would probably be dead. Spend years in psychotherapy trying to forgive yourself and develop some self-compassion, and the other person's long gone from this world. There, while you're still on the cushion. So, the change that's needed there is what will bridge the gap. And it's a kind of 180 degree about turn in the emotional life to go from guilt to self-forgiveness. It's, to me, listening to lots of people, it's too much to ask of the heart just to be able to do that there. And perhaps, therefore, the direction and the exploration is to, that's easy, forget all this self-self, I feel bad, and I want to feel good about myself, forget all that distraction there, and rather instead, look at the event. Can there be some resolution of the event? So it's not about I, me, me, self-forgiving, but it's the event. And perhaps in the event, if one has engaged in some activity which one knows hurts somebody, by the voice, by the violence, by the carelessness, by the indifference, and it's really haunting one's inner life, that really is giving pain to one's inner life. It's not about self-forgiveness. It's about writing to the person and giving a very deep apology. It's writing not a text, never, ever a text, nor an email. It's handwritten. You write something, not pages and pages. The person will not want to read it. Just a few lines, carefully expressed, clear and easy to read, and therefore the empathy is communicating itself very, very directly to the other, if she or he is still alive, to the other, and that empathy is showing itself in the action. You're not waiting around to forgive yourself. You're actually engaging in something to show that there is a mindfulness and awareness which acknowledges the pain given to the other, and there is a communication of one's acknowledgement there, and possibly, of course, asking the person to understand oneself and one's very deep regret and deep apology for the hurt or the harm that one has caused. Then there may be some potential for some resolution. And empathy is about expressing that kind of potential. It doesn't mean to say that the other person will forgive. They may not reply, they may express appreciation, but something from the deep of the being has been communicated, and that's one huge step. And a few times in 40 years of giving retreats, so, have mentioned to a few people who have said to me, Christopher, I'm really going through a really big issue, I really cause person or persons harm, or their families, or whoever it may be, and I really have to do something about this. I'm not living with myself well like this. I said, okay, write something. If you wish, you can show me or not. Write something. So the person's gone to the room, got some paper, got some pen, and just written something out and slept on it and polished it and sent it and communicated. And I think there's something quite beautiful and rather profound when we can go that deep, feel the empathy, have a sense of how the other person feels there. I told story, and it touched me. I heard it 20 years ago, and in this particular case, it took place during the Russian Revolution, a true story. And a couple who were engaged, who were in their early 20s, were engaged in warfare, street warfare during the time of the Russian Revolution. And of all the tragedies of war, in this particular one, the soldier and his partner, they were close together, and in some painful set of circumstances, he fired and he killed his partner. And this brought about in him incredible remorse, terrible pain, horrendous guilt. And just in a split moment, she turned, he fired, and he didn't realize it was her there. And he carried this with him, and he did meditation, he was a religious man, he did much prayer, and he spoke with various people in therapy, and still, years went by, is 30 or 40 years went by, and still carrying this remorse, and this guilt, and this anguish of there. And then one rather lovely Russian Orthodox priest, he met with him, this is 30, 40 years later, and he said to the Russian Orthodox priest, this story, which I just told you, and a Russian Orthodox priest told me, he told the Russian Orthodox priest what happened, and he said, I still can't resolve this, and I have to resolve this before I die, the years are going by. And the priest said to him, close your eyes, look inside, because she, your fiancé, is still inside there, the memory and the experience and the love. And he said, ask for forgiveness from within. Don't ask God to forgive you. Don't try, just ask for forgiveness there. And meditated, went to a very quiet period, and made this request for forgiveness. And a very strong voice came out just from nowhere. And the words were, of course, you're forgiven. And sometimes with life, and the fragrance of life, and the feelings and the emotions of life, in the encounter with life, the soldier and his partner, the difficulties that we have with another, the difficulties that we have with ourselves, sometimes we have to look in a way at an event, at an encounter, which we have not considered before. And the teaching of mindfulness genuinely have a real, and Buddha makes much reference to this, to a creative energy to apply to situations. So what I mean with regard to empathy with life and connection and closeness and to bridging these gaps between us as human beings, can I ask myself sometimes, what would be a creative approach to the resolution of this problem, to the resolution of this encounter? What would, on my side, even though the other, whoever she is, he is, or they are, even if they never, ever change. And sometimes they don't. And sometimes we don't either. But we have a practice. So sometimes the other, whoever the other may be, is going to be just as he or she is, and they are not going to change. No. And therefore there is an encounter with the unchangeable, not a profound unchangeable, but an unchangeable. Despite the other being the same, or being indecisive, or whatever we complain about, can I, as a human being, in my relationship to the other, find a creative way to be clear and see the truth of the situation in a fresh way? And this truth, whatever that might be, is the one truth that really matters. It's the truth of a fresh discovery. It's the truth of a new realization. It's the truth of the heart looking in a different way. It's the truth of going deeper than this cultural relativity. It's the truth which takes down the walls. And this truth is the one truth which is genuinely liberating. And this is our exploration. Let's have a quiet minute, Jill. May all beings live with empathy. May all beings live with love. May all beings touch upon truth, which enables us to see clearly. Good. Thank you for lending an ear.